I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Almost every move we make on the internet is tracked, from late-night shoe shopping to the directions you ask for on your phone, and all that data can be valuable. Today, learn how universities, including the University of Kansas, are using tracking software to rank prospective students before they apply. We'll find out what admission departments are looking for and whether students can use the system to their advantage. Then, last-minute gift buyers, this show is for you. We've got expert recommendations from our good friends at the Johnson County Library. They have book ideas for young readers of all levels. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's called student tracking, and it's the latest way universities try to figure out which high school students might be good prospects. They do this even before the students apply to attend the universities. One of the schools that takes part in this practice is the University of Kansas, which declined to discuss it with the Washington Post. The Post wrote about the new way of identifying prospective students in a lengthy story in October. The practice raises all manner of ethical questions, including whether it undermines the prospects of poor students who might struggle to pay for tuition. Yes, the software used to do the tracking can figure out a family's income. Here to talk about student tracking are Noor Haddad. She's a counselor at CollegeWise, the nation's largest college counseling organization. She joins us from the studios of Orange County Public Radio in Irvine, California. Noor, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Doug McMillan is a corporate accountability reporter for The Washington Post. He was one of the authors of the Post story on this, and he joins us from NPR in Washington. Doug, good morning to you.
Hi. It's great to be with you.
Doug, so what we're saying here is that colleges are now using the same technologies that track what you do online to help them decide what students are worthy of considering for admission even before they apply. Do I have that right?
Yeah, a lot of schools are out there are trying to just gather more information about the giant pool of potential recruits to try to narrow that down to who they should focus their recruiting on. This can take many different forms. They can go out and actually buy data from data broker firms sometimes. One of the practices that we focused on, though, had to do with using tracking cookies in a similar way as internet companies like Facebook and Google will use tracking cookies to essentially track your behavior on a website. We found a surprising number of universities are using a similar technology to track the behavior and the web browsing activity of potential students when they visit their university website.
Doug, is that a problem?
It depends on who you ask. Many mm-hmm. of the people at these universities say, you know, we're not doing this to for any purpose other than to decide who to focus on, who should we prioritize our recruiting efforts on. If you know, and they say that they can add a lot of value to the recruiting and the admissions process. If a student comes and visits the University of Kansas website, just as a hypothetical example, and they spend a lot of time on the athletics pages, for example, the admissions office or the recruiting office could then use that information to say, this is a person who we should send more information about our athletic scholarships. So mm-hmm. they see a potential way to get more information they can use to help that student in the recruiting process. A lot of other people that we talk to think that, you know, there are serious privacy issues here. One of the main ones is the vast majority of these schools who use this technology are not being transparent about it in the privacy policies or anywhere else.
You know, Noor, you work with a lot of students. How do you size up this practice of student tracking?
Definitely. So I think what's important to know is that student tracking is just part of this process. And one thing I do want to explain to kind of explain the motivation behind tracking mm-hmm. is this concept of demonstrated interest. So many colleges and universities track this concept of how interested this student is in their university. And if a student wants to find out more about how that's being used, they can find out a little bit more if they're digging into the college's admissions website. But if I'm going to explain that concept, it is part of a whole process of a bunch of factors that are taken into account when a student is being evaluated by university.
So, Nora, what you're saying is if my son or daughter is spending a lot of time looking at the KU website, for instance, and the KU can figure that out now. They can tell how much time my son or daughter is spending to maybe get a sense of how interested my son or daughter is in the school.
Absolutely. And I think that what's important to really explain is that it's just part of showing interest in the school. So if your son or daughter is also attending a campus tour, or if they're emailing an admission officer that they met at a college fair, that's also part of demonstrated interest.
But the difference here is that in a lot of cases, as Doug just explained, the prospective student doesn't know the college is sort of, quote, spying on them in that way.
You could think of it as spying, but I think I would also try to explain that many websites are using this. And so when a student is agreeing to accept cookies on a website, they might not read the entire terms of service, just as many people wouldn't. And I think that that can, yes, be misleading. But I also think that when you are trying to break it down as something that's not necessarily malicious, then you're really removing fear from this process and understanding that a college is trying to use it to get more information about you, just as any other website would for a particular consumer or client.
But Doug, one point in your story was that a lot of these prospective students have no idea they're accepting cookies, have no idea what bargain they're entering into here.
Yeah. The colleges who are using this to gather information, you know, they are borrowing practices from the private sector here. These are, you know, one of the most common defenses I heard of this practice as I went out and talked to these universities was, we're not doing anything that the normal web surfer encounters when they visit an e-commerce website, when they visit a social network. Those companies are also tracking you. One of the big differences, though, is that the universities are doing a very poor job of disclosing these practices. Typically, when you go to Facebook or Google website or Amazon website, they will include in their cookie notice or their privacy policy some detailed explanation of why they are using those cookies. What are they using it for? If you go into the privacy policy for a university who is doing this, they are not. We didn't find any cases where they are explaining that they are using these cookies in the recruiting or admissions process. So I think it's, you know, if universities want to continue using this kind of technology and do it in a way that, you know, doesn't violate the trust or at least makes potential students, potential recruits cautious about their relationship with that school, then it's the onus is on them. It behooves them to be more transparent about what they're doing.
I was going to say, Nora, we don't think of colleges, I think at least most people don't, as businesses in the same sense as we do, you know, say Banana Republic or a nearby restaurant. We think of them as somehow above all that. But is that turning into something of a naive view now?
I would say that, you know, that would be the hope, right? That would be the hope that an educational institution would stay an educational institution. But the reality is that universities are using marketing departments. And so they want to make sure that their marketing initiatives are successful. They want to make sure that they're reaching students that they want to reach. And I would agree with some parts of this article where it does feed into the inequity of the system, where a student might not even have a computer at home or a smartphone. That student is not going to be able to answer emails at the same rate or check on a website and click around at the same rate as somebody who has a laptop at home. So I think that it's important to understand that, yes, educational institutions want to be pure, but they have to meet their quota of students at the end of the day.
So, Nora, from your standpoint, that's a concern. The Post raised that concern. It's a concern to you, too, that poorer prospective students might be at a disadvantage here.
Yes, absolutely. But they're also at a disadvantage in every other part of the process. So I think that it's important to take this into account when you're thinking about this in relation to all other parts of the system that are inequitable. So when you're thinking about student tracking, yes, it is going to be beneficial to someone who has a computer at home, but you also have to think about the colleges who are not visiting lower income districts, who are not visiting students who are in rural communities that have one high school in, you know, a very long distance. So when these schools are not visiting students and they're not, you know, they're not contacting them, they're not doing high school visits, that's also part of the inequity of the system.
Doug McMillan from the Washington Post, what do colleges and universities say about what Noor just said, this idea that poorer students might be at something of a disadvantage here?
Well, a lot of the companies, or sorry, a lot of the universities, rather, that we talked to for this piece and that we found were using these practices are not the elite schools. These are primarily the schools that are struggling to attract new students, that are struggling to compete in the marketplace for new high school graduates. And they also don't necessarily have a large endowment to support them. So these are universities that are behaving more like companies out of necessity, and some out of desperation. So from that point of view, these recruitment officials and admissions officials are looking to recruit an incoming class of students who, you know, in some respects can afford to pay tuition and can afford to help them meet their revenue goals.
Right.
Most of them won't tell you it, won't say it like that explicitly, maybe, but there are, you know, the reality of being a university, you know, a mid-tier university today that is not a Harvard or a Stanford, is that you have to find a way to fulfill your revenue goals, and part of that process is recruiting students who can afford to pay.
Doug, I can't help but notice that you're mixing up the words company and university sometimes in your conversation, and that's the point of your story, right? That's what we're talking about here, this idea of student tracking.
Yeah, I actually had a chance to visit this is a whole industry. This university admissions professionals now are in kind of a whole industry, and there are a whole industry of consultants that has grown up to serve and to sell products to these schools. I actually had a chance to visit over the summer a conference in Nashville, Tennessee, where there was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of admissions professionals who were meeting to get education and training and tools and hear pitches from these kind of companies who are selling them services that are used to, you know, slice and dice the data of mm-hmm. potential incoming students.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about this practice of student tracking. It's the latest way that universities try to figure out what high school students might be good prospects for them. They do this even before the students apply to attend the universities. We're visiting with Doug McMillan, who's a reporter from the Washington Post, who's written about this, and Noor Haddad, a counselor at College Wise, the nation's largest college counseling organization. Noor, how many colleges and universities are engaged in this practice these days? What do you know about that?
Definitely. So, I mean, hundreds of universities are participating in this. I think even before the software tracking was available, institutions like the College Board were selling data to colleges so mm-hmm. that they could find out more from students. So as soon as a student takes the PSAT or the SAT or any of the introductory tests to introduce them to standardized testing, that data is also being sold to these universities, and that's where a lot of this is coming from. So when we're talking about tracking, I want to make sure to clarify that, you know, you're not going to be able to find out things like household income from data tracking if that's not something that's available on the website, but it is from these data collections in other areas.
Mm-hmm. And Noor, in response to what Doug said a few minutes ago about the focus here being on universities struggling to attract students, how much pressure is on colleges and universities these days, admissions counselors, when it comes to increasing enrollments?
Absolutely. And I think I would also agree with that statement that Doug was making. I think that a lot of public institutions are wanting to make sure that they're meeting their enrollment goals. And so if I may clarify, to just expand upon this, a lot of universities like the University of Kansas that have, you know, that are trying to attract more students are reaching out of state. So you're going to find a lot of universities that have regional representatives, for example. So in California, we have the University of California system and the Cal State system, the California State system. A lot of students are having a hard time getting into those schools or finishing in 4 years because they're so full. So many of these public institutions from out of state are either putting a regional representative that lives in California or lives in the Western region to make sure that they have someone on the ground to recruit students from out of state and incentivize them with merit scholarships because they know that they're going to be able to pay out-of-state tuition. So this is a practice that has been increasing for a long time, and it's important to know all of the pieces to the puzzle of how a college can attract those types of students and where they're looking.
Noor, I can't help but wonder if these days, as you work with prospective college students, if you're advising them to spend a lot of time on the websites of their college, of their different colleges of choice, because the college will soon find out that they're spending a lot of time on their site and that might make them more attractive to them and increase their chances. Is that part of the strategy now?
To be honest with you, that's not where my focus would lie. I would focus more on making good connections with an admission counselor that you might have met at a fair or at your high school visit, writing an essay about why you want to attend that school and giving real examples about the academic program you want to apply to or the extracurricular activities you want to take part in specifically at that university. Those, to me, are where the student should focus way more, because if you're just poking around, spending your time clicking on every single part of the website, that's not a valuable use of a student's time to me.
Yeah.
And I think that they can find more genuine ways to focus on demonstrating their level of interest to a college.
Doug, do you have any idea how long this practice has been going on, this practice of tracking students?
Some of the technologies we're talking about, this tracking technology and using cookies, is pretty new and relatively new, and schools have been starting to experiment with that really over the past few years. But the idea of using data in the admissions and recruiting process has definitely been around for at least a couple decades at some of the schools who kind of pioneered this trend. And a lot of it revolves around scoring. So inside these admissions recruiting offices, universities are trying to look at a pool of potentially tens of thousands of high school seniors who are going to be in their potential class of recruits. And they're trying to sort through that list and apply scores to each one of those students that measure their likelihood of potentially applying to our school or their likelihood of enrolling in the school. And they are using more and more and more data to try to improve the accuracy of those scores, because at colleges that are cash strapped or that only have a team of, you know, a dozen recruiters or less, they can only call so many of those students, and they can only send mailers out to so many of those students. So what data is going into these profiles and these scores has evolved over time, and recently it started adding. They've started adding this element of web tracking. But a lot of what goes into that data is, like Noor was saying, when students fill out a questionnaire when they take the SAT or the ACT, that forms kind of some of the information that goes into that data profile. These universities can go out and buy data, like I said before, from a third party data company. Sometimes that can connect those students to their zip code, and knowing a student's zip code can unlock a lot of information about their likely household income. And that's one of the biggest elements of this data packages. Again, knowing which students are the likeliest to afford a tuition, and knowing what are the factors that show this student is interested in attending our school.
I was going to say, Doug, what information is out there that would enable a college or university to know if any one particular high school student might be even inclined to apply to that particular school? Is it the same consumer information that companies are gathering on, you know, me as I go about my daily life?
Yeah, the latest technology on this, it's pretty interesting. They are, a lot of universities are assembling data on all of the students who previously enrolled. So they are collecting data on all the students who are their freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors, and building an algorithm that says these are the types of students
right.
that enroll. These are usually what they get on their standardized tests. These are where they're from, how far away geographically they are located from our school campus. And they have hundreds and hundreds of other data fields. Think of it like a giant spreadsheet that they roll into this algorithm. And then what you can do with that computer model is you can say, when you have a potential recruit, you can say, how closely does this potential recruit compare to this spreadsheet? Does it mm-hmm. look like somebody who usually attends the University of Kansas? And from that, they can make a determination, well, this person is more likely to enroll because they look like somebody who already went here.
So this is basically, again, Doug, maybe to repeat some points here, this is basically the same sort of practice that's going on in our society now, where these students are bouncing around Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Amazon, and profiles are being built of them. From a consumer standpoint, we're just adjusting this for a higher education point of view. Again, am
yeah.
I seeing that right?
That's right. It's an algorithm. It's mm-hmm. it's a way of trying to simplify a very complex question to something that, you know, somebody, a recruiter, can just punch a few things into a computer
right.
and it can spit out an answer. The problem with that, like many algorithms in our society as they kind of pop up in more and more places, is what are the flaws that are being baked into that algorithm?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, one of the other problems is can these algorithms be more transparent? All of the universities that we talked to from my story, except one, Mississippi State University, refused to give us the breakdown of their algorithm. Mississippi State actually gave us the percentages that go into their scoring
wow.
algorithm.
Wow.
But the vast majority of universities don't make this public. And why not? Why shouldn't potential students know how they're being measured by recruits and what's going to give them a better score? So I think that there's definitely going to be probably more of a push to make these kinds of predictions and algorithms transparent.
And Noor Haddad, as we've gone through this conversation, I haven't sensed a lot of concern or even outrage from you about this practice. Am I seeing that correctly?
Steve, I wouldn't say that it's outrage. I think that, of course, like any other system, there are going to be problems with it. But I think that when you're informed about how, or at least as informed as you can be about how this information is used, then the fear diminishes from you. Now, if I may add on to what Doug was saying before.
Sure.
So he's talking about an algorithm, and yes, people have scoring mechanisms, and they might have percentages that they're not necessarily revealing to the public. But if a student or parent wanted to really dig into how a student is evaluated by a university, they can look up something called a common data set, which is used by nearly every university in this country, and is this repository of information where you can look at how on what level a college is using a piece of data to evaluate that student.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there are academic qualifications like the GPA, the ranking if a school ranks a student, the standardized testing, the essay, and the letters of recommendation. But there are also qualitative factors like personal character and how they do in the interview and what mm-hmm. kind of extracurricular activities they take part in. So based on those factors, you can see whether a college ranks them as very important, considered, and not at all important. So you can find out, when we're talking about demonstrated interest, if a school even tracks that information.
Right.
So
right.
you can find out some bare bones information about this and what might be important for a student in the process. But I think it's important to make sure that we're not conflating the sphere of an algorithm when there are people reading these students' applications and they are really looking mm-hmm. at other qualitative factors. I don't want students to fear that they're just a number. And
you're
so
saying the traditional ways of evaluating prospective students still continue today.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think student tracking is just one piece of the
gotcha.
Data that is added.
Well, I want to thank our guests for a good conversation. So much of this was new to me. That was the voice of Noor Haddad, a counselor at CollegeWise, the nation's largest college counseling organization. We were also joined by Doug McMillan, who's written about this issue of student tracking for the Washington Post. He joined us this morning from NPR in Washington. Thank you both for a good conversation.
Thank you so
Thanks much,
very Steve.
Much.
Coming up, book recommendations from our friends at the Johnson County Library. I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Did you catch my latest column in Kraske Off Mic? That's the up-to-date newsletter that you can sign up for at kcur.org/Kraske. It's quick and easy, and you won't miss the next one. Go to kcur.org/Kraske. Impeachment hearings will likely keep up-to-date off the air tomorrow, but we'll be back later in the week to run down the latest indie, documentary, and foreign films playing locally. So how about giving that child in your life a good book for the holidays? But which books to give? After all, there are a whole lot of them out there these days. Today we'll run down some great books for kids of all ages with our Johnson County librarians. They're in the house brimming with ideas, and we're about to run them down for you. With us from the Johnson County Library are Debbie McLeod. She's our librarian emeritus. Debbie, always good to have you here. Welcome
back.
Hi,
Steve. Great to be back.
Dennis Ross is back. He's the Youth Services Supervisor. Dennis, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Elena McVicker is here also. She's the Youth Collections Librarian. Elena, how are you?
I'm good.
Well, let's get right to it because we have a lengthy list here. But I just wanted to put out a call. If parents are home with kids today because schools are shut down, at least on the Missouri side, and one of your children wants to give us a call to recommend a good book, we want to hear from kids. Our number, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Elena, let's get to your first one here. Ark of a Scythe for grades 9 and up.
Yeah, this is actually, so all the books I'm going to recommend today are parts of a finished series. I am a picky reader. I don't like to read series until they're completely out.
Mm-hmm.
Which
is
sometimes,
that right?
Yeah.
You don't want to wait.
Well,
you have no patience is what you're admitting to the public here.
Yes, this is not a secret. No patience at all. And so I'll wait until the whole series is out. So these are series that completed this year. So if you have really voracious readers who will just rip through books like no others, you can buy them the entire series and hopefully keep them occupied for a week or two.
Yeah.
But this one, the first book is called Scythe. It is about a world where there's no hunger, there's no sickness, and there's no death. And because there's no death, they need a specialized faction of people called Scythes, and the Scythes decide who dies and
oh my gosh.
How.
Yeah.
And the world is controlled by an artificial intelligence called the Thunderhead, and the Thunderhead and the Scythe do not speak. And so it follows two teenagers who have been apprenticed as Scythes. One is interested and the other is very not interested in the apprenticeship. And it goes into questions about morality and society, because this society sounds like something we should be striving for. But it sort of talks about the issues therein. And so the first one's Scythe. The second one is Thunderhead. And the third one just came out is called The Toll.
Mm-hmm. Well, Neil Schusterman is the author, and it sounds like Neil's got quite the imagination.
He does. He's a really great author, and if people find these books interesting, he has a whole backlist of titles to keep your teens reading. So this is for teens. This is probably the most popular series that ended this year. I had the most requests for purchases from people
really?
Months in advance. I was like, it doesn't come out for 6 months. So, our holds list is quite lengthy on the last one.
The book Ark of a Scythe, the author Neil Schusterman. We'll try to get all these books up on our website later on today if people want to go check them out. Debbie, you're up with your first one here, Field Trip to the Moon by John Hare.
Yes, this is one that's in a totally different demographic. This is a wordless picture book. And this book sort of commemorates the landing on the moon in a way. There were a lot of books that came out this past year recognizing that anniversary of that wonderful event. And in this one, it tells of a school trip to the moon. And this one little student, we don't know whether it's a boy or a girl because they all have spacesuits on, gets somehow left behind. And what he discovers on the moon is pretty incredible. And it's very imaginative. It's totally different from a lot of the other books that was commemorating the moon landing. And it's done by a local illustrator. So that's really, I like to promote local authors and illustrators, and this is really very well done.
We're running down good kids' book. Debbie's first one, Field Trip to the Moon by John Hare. And if you're a kid out there who wants to join our conversation with a recommendation, we're all ears this morning. 816-235-2888. Ava from Blue Springs. Ava, you're 6 years old and you're calling me. I'm glad you did. Are you there, Ava?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Ava.
Hi.
What's your recommendation?
I'd like to recommend the Fire Cat.
The Fire Cats?
Oh, yeah.
What's that about, Ava?
It's about this nice cat who gets to work with the firemen.
Ah. Do the firemen like Ava? Like the cat?
Yes.
Yeah. And what's the cat's name?
Pickles.
Pickles? Well, how could you not like a cat named Pickles, Ava? How did you find this book? You still there, Ava?
Yes.
Yeah. How did you find this book?
Is that from the library?
Yeah, okay. Hey.
Yes.
The library. Well, that's really... I sure am glad you called with your recommendation about the Fire Cats, Ava. I hope you have a good holiday, too, okay? Thanks for calling us today.
And that's an oldie but a goodie.
Is it an oldie
but
a goodie?
Yeah, it's an oldie but a goodie. So it's kind of cool to hear a kid talking about a book that's, gosh, it came out probably in the
60s. 1960,
yeah.
I just looked it up.
Yeah, yeah, it's a cool little book. Averill, I believe, is the...
Esther Averill.
Yeah.
Well, before I forget, Gina Kaufman, my colleague, fellow host on Central Standard, has recommended a book titled The Neighbors by Einat Sarfati, and it's a book that came out, published in Israel in 2017, about a girl who lives in a 7-story apartment building. She likes to sit outside each door to imagine who lives inside. All kinds of zany stories of these interesting people. The girl thinks that her family isn't all that interesting, but then she comes to find out that, in fact, they really are. Gina says she's crazy about this book. She's bought it for a bunch of relatives. Again, it's The Neighbors by Einat Sarfati, and I think it's been translated into English just in the last year, and she can't recommend it enough here. So
wow.
It's a good one.
That sounds excellent.
Yeah. Dennis, you're up with Infinite Hope, A Black Artist's Journey from World War II to Peace by Ashley Bryan, grades 5 through adult.
Yes, this one just really knocked me out. I'd been hearing and reading a lot of buzz about it, and then it's on people's favorite lists, and I just really didn't know it was going to be as awesome as it is before I picked it up. Ashley Bryan is an artist, yes, and he's best known for these really vibrantly illustrated folk tales and poetry books for kids. And he even got a Newbery Honor for Freedom Over Me, a book from a few years back. This is a autobiography, and it's just a beautiful work of art in its own right. Hmm. And it's a departure for him. He was drafted into the Army in 1943, a very segregated U.S. Army during World War II, and he had been in his third year at Cooper Union, an art school in New York City. And as you might know, soldiers of color endured terrible abuse and mistreatment and injustices during the war. They were often treated worse than the Nazi POWs. And they got the worst jobs. You know, they had to clean things up,
right,
load things and bury the dead. And they're even told to remove the black soldiers first because the newsreels didn't want them to be shown. And so the whole time he kept making art, though. He just had to make art. And he had stuffed pencils and drawing paper in his gas mask. He just had to keep making art. It was one of the things that helped get him through. So, but for 40 years after the war, he never told anybody about his experiences there. He kept them all to himself until some time in the 90s when somebody encouraged him to come out and start telling his stories. And so this is how he's doing it. And every page in this book is just a multimedia masterpiece, basically.
Wow, yeah. You're showing it to me here. It looks amazing.
New artwork and some old sketches from the war and handwritten letters home to his friends and diary entries and photographs and new paintings. And it just... And he talks about how the support of some kind people and his passion for art really helped him get through this ordeal. And I think the book is just a real treasure.
The book, again, Infinite Hope, A Black Artist's Journey from World War II to Peace by Ashley Bryan. Again, grades 5 through adult. Dennis Ross, very high on it here. Our phone number here, if kids want to call us with their recommendations, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Lucy from Kansas City, Kansas. She's 14 years old. Lucy, thanks for calling.
Hi.
Well,
I'm so glad you called, Lucy. What do you want to recommend to us?
Well, I love the book Never Let Me Go. It's a dystopian series. Well, it's not a series. It's a dystopian romantic tragedy kind of book.
About kids growing up thinking about the past, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What did you like about it?
Well, I just liked kind of the nostalgic aspects of it. And it had like kind of a creepy undertone.
Mm-hmm. That's always good.
The kids are like trying to figure out why they have to like give their body parts away, basically. So.
Wow. Okay. Well, Lucy, I appreciate your phone call. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's continue on our journey of recommendations for good kids' books this year. Let's move on to another one here, The Folk of the Air by Holly Black. We already done that one, right?
No, we haven't done this
Elena,
one yet.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, go ahead. Yeah.
No worries. The series is called The Folk of the Air. And Holly Black did not make people wait very long for this series. She published three books within 2 years, mm-hmm. And it is complete. The first book is called The Cruel Prince. It's about a girl named Jude, and she was 7 when strangers broke into her house, murdered her parents, and she was whisked away to the High Court of Faery. Mm. And so this takes place in a magical, fantastical setting. And she has kept her head down for many years as one of the only humans living in the court until she finally decides to start getting involved in sort of the affairs of and take control of her life. And so if you're into like courtly intrigue and of course there's a little romance in this one, this series would probably be good for you. The first one's called The Cruel Prince. The second is The Wicked King. And the last one that just came out is called The Queen of Nothing.
Again, for grades 5 through adult here, The Folk of the Air by Holly Black. Hey, when you talk about parents being murdered, it might be hard for kids to wrap their arms around.
I mean, Disney does it all the time.
Bambi's
mom. Well, Disney does it. It's okay then, right?
Yeah, right. This is sort of talked about a lot in children's lit. Sometimes something you need to do to give the kids autonomy and sort of be able to have mm-hmm. them in all these situations that normally their parents would be like, what are you doing? Unfortunately, to have the parents out of the pictures. And so it's a trope that some people struggle with, of mm-hmm. course. And there are, every time I do find a book with good parents, it's like, oh, it can be done. But yeah, it happens in the first couple of pages. So if your teen is not into reading sort of that striking.
You want to go there, don't go there.
You can skip the first 5 pages and be good.
The Folk of the Air by Holly Black. Let's move on here to Debbie McLeod's next one here, Queen of the Sea. Debbie, tell us about it.
Well, this is a graphic novel, and it's an amazing book. I think it's one of my favorite books of the year. It's been on a lot of best books list. And it is an alternative world where the Kingdom of Albion, which is basically England, and it's Elizabethan England, and about this young girl who we don't know her background. She is on this island. She's been raised by nuns. And the piece that we're going to hear, it sort of like introduces her and what she thinks about being. She doesn't know who her parents are. She just has these 12 people on the island with her, 10 of whom or 9 of them are nuns. And it's an amazing book. It really is.
Well, UpToDate's producer Danny Alexander is going to read a little bit here from Queen of the Sea.
The other child on the island was in a painting hung in the chapter house, which is the big room where everybody gathers for important meetings or special announcements. It was a picture of King Edmund, the ruler of Albion, with his daughter, Eleanor. At first, because of her red hair, I thought that the little girl in the picture might be me, although her ball was much fancier than my wooden one. I found out later that she wasn't even holding a ball to play with, but an important thing called a globus cruciger that represents the whole world and means you are a person who rules over part of it, with God's permission, of course. So I wasn't jealous of her useless ball anymore, but she did have a father who let her sit on his lap. I thought that he must be very proud of her and love her very much. Sometimes I would visit the painting of the princess and her father, the king, and imagine for a little while that it really was me sitting on his lap and that he told me stories of the wicked world and all the ways a good and kind ruler could make it better. Or I would visit the statue of the mournful mother and pretend that I had once been a baby made of wood on her lap and that she had brought me to life and given me to the sisters of the island so that one of her children wouldn't grow up to be so sad. No one could be sad living on the island, I thought. But since my living there meant that I couldn't have my real mother and father with me, I decided that it was reasonable to ask God for something in return, the one thing I really wanted. And if your will, please, bring another child to the island. That is how I met William.
That's Danny Alexander reading from Queen of the Sea, recommended for grades 5 through 7. Danny, thank you. And let's go to Katie from Ozaukee, Kansas, who's a local author there. Katie, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for letting me come on. I just wanted to say I know that a lot of places in the Kansas City area, Lawrence, Topeka, and so forth, like to have local people. And I have just recently gotten my first book out. I am an author, and my series is called Down Home on the Farm. And each of the books that comes out has a different tale told by Tom T, who is a turkey. And this is for preschoolers through on the Lexile rating, 4.2 on the Lexile rating. And he tells the stories and helps them out with the problems and so forth. And I do want to say it is bilingual. It is in Spanish and English. And the illustrations are done by someone who has ties to this area as well. And they are absolutely beautiful acrylic on canvas.
Well, sounds good, Katie. Good luck with the series, and thanks so much for calling. I appreciate it. Dennis, let's go to another one here. Beverly, right here by Kate DiCamillo, who's been on the show a couple of times, a big favorite of Up to Date, this book for grades 5 and up. Kate, a huge success in this world.
Yes, I like to say by the incomparable Kate DiCamillo.
Yeah, no, I get that.
This is the third book in a cycle about three girls who are friends. Ramey Nightingale and Louisiana's Way Home were the first two, and they were the stories of the two of the girls. And now it's Beverly Topinski's turn. And Beverly's 14 when she runs away from home. Her beloved dog Buddy has just died, and her no-show mother might not even notice that she's gone for a while. So she hitches a ride and ends up in this little seaside town in Florida. And she meets an elderly woman who's a little bit of a character and offers her a place to stay in her house because she needs somebody to drive her to bingo, and she doesn't have anybody else to do it. And she also finds a job bussing tables in a local diner, and she meets all kinds of colorful characters, you know how Kate does. And she acts all tough and confident, but really she's very vulnerable. She's just trying to find herself. And just about the time she starts to find herself a little bit, she really starts realizing that she misses her friend Ramey back at home. And so DiCamillo, like, she writes prose like a poet, is what I tell people. She, like, every word is in exactly the right place. There are no extra words you don't need.
Right.
And they all pierce, like, straight to your heart.
I remember taking her over to Westwood View Elementary one time when she was here. Oh. The kids just loved her.
Oh, sure. So, yeah. This one's about friendship, and it's a story of hope, and it's just beautiful.
The book, again, Beverly Right Here by Kate DiCamillo for grades 5 and up. Okay, Elena, let's go to The Bone Witch here.
So this is about a world of witches, and Tia lives in it with her mother and her family. She's very close to her brother, and women wield magical power. Her mom and sisters have powers like they can manipulate the forest and they can manipulate water, and they haven't quite figured out what she can do yet. Uh-huh. And while they're still trying to figure that out, her brother is tragically killed in a war. And so I think we're going to have a read aloud here, and you will figure out what her power is from this passage.
Yeah, Jamie Hobbs from the Up-to-Date team is going to read here from The Bone Witch for grade seven and up. Jamie.
It was wrong of them to put him in the ground when he did not want to die. A strange symbol burned before me. Without thinking, my bloody fingers traced the pattern in the air again and again and again until my brothers took me by the waist and dragged me away. "What has gotten into you, girl?" My father was shaken and angry. "There is no excuse for behaving in this manner, and at your brother's wake, no less." What other reprimands he intended died on his tongue when the ground began to move. A terrible rumbling and heaving began underneath us, beneath the fresh dirt that made up Fox's grave. There was a muffled splintering inside the small mound, like something within the coffin had escaped its confinement. As we watched, a cold, gray hand rose up, scratching and stretching, and gripped the tufts of weeds growing close to the grave. The strange being lifted itself out of its earthly prison with little difficulty and brushed the dirt off its tall, thin form. My mother fainted. When it raised its head, I saw that it had my brother's face, drawn and bloodless and dead. "Tia," the figure said. but then it smiled, and it was Fox's smile, quiet and kind.
That's Jamie Hobbs reading from The Bone Witch, again, for grade 7 and up there. Debbie, let's go to, again, we're just surveying good kids' books to give for the holidays. Let's go to Vroom by Barbara McClintock. This is for preschool, kindergarten age kids.
Well, this is another book that's been really very well received.
Vroom.
Vroom.
Yeah.
And it's about a little girl who loves her little race car. And in her imagination, she travels all over with her little race car. And the illustrations are great. Barbara McClintock is known for very detailed illustrations, a lot of old-fashioned kind of look to them. But this, it's very modern, this little red-haired girl with her poof of red hair outside of her helmet. And she just loves seeing all the different sides. But in the end, she's glad to come home. And it's really great because it's
to her cozy bed, the description says.
Yes, it is, you know. And
it's true for all of us.
Here you have a little girl who's really into cars. So sort of a little different. And I just really liked it.
Vroom by Barbara McClintock here. Dennis, Look Both Ways, A Tale Told in 10 Blocks by Jason Reynolds for grades 5 through 8. Tell us about it.
Yeah, and Jason Reynolds is another very well-known name in the world of kids and teens literature. Like it says, there's 10 stories, and there's one tale for each block. And there's
for
one story
each block,
for each block of in the neighborhood around the school.
Oh,
so each one is about a different group of middle grade students from the same school, but they're all going their different ways after school.
Mm-hmm.
And each story is about each one of these groups of kids, but they are obviously interrelated. So the stories kind of overlap in some spots, and they connect in other spots. And some of the same teachers, and some of the same kids, and the same crossing guard, and the same custodian, and the same old lady on the corner who sells candy to the kids when they have some spare change. But each of the characters is distinct, and they're all really very engaging, and their stories are funny and sad and touching, and some of them are even tragic. So with each story, the farther you get into the book, the more you feel like you know the neighborhood. You feel like you know you're there, and you know who these people are, which is a little unusual for me since this is, you know, New York City. You know?
Right.
There's one group of four kids that hustles for spare change to help their parents who are cancer patients. And there's another boy who gets his friends to clean him all up so he can ask a girl for a phone number. And another boy who gets jumped because he stood up for his friend saying it's okay for boys to kiss other boys. And another girl who wants to just be left alone so she can be the best skateboarder around. And another guy who tries to sell his best friend on his theory that basically we're all just boogers. And so the book is just full of heart, like pretty much all of Jason Reynolds' books are, and he's a genius.
Look Both Ways, A Tale Told in 10 Blocks by Jason Reynolds, again, grades 5 through 8. Elena, let's squeeze in another one here before we got to go. We got about 45 seconds. Renegades by Marissa Mayer for grades 7 and up.
Sure. So this series is good to give teens and middle graders who are really interested in superheroes. It kind of takes the same superhero tropes and spins them on their head. There's two factions, the anarchists and the renegades. And it kind of dives into, again, questions of morality, questions of how to govern and who is right and who is wrong and who gets to make those decisions. And it features a girl named Nova who infiltrates the renegades.
Right.
To try to take vengeance for her parents, again, her parents' death. but it's just a really rocking good read. The superpowers are really fun to hear about. There's some non-traditional ones, and then there's your traditional ones, and sort of hearing how they train the superheroes. And it's a really fun, fast read. And there's three of them, Renegades, Archenemies, and Supernova just came out.
Okay, Renegades, again, the book that Elena just recommended by Marissa Mayer. I want to thank our Johnson County librarians once again for coming in and giving us some great ideas here. Debbie McLeod, Dennis Ross, and Elena McVicker, thank you all. Happy holidays
to you.
Thank you.
Happy holidays to you.
Thanks, Steve.
And to everyone out there.
You bet. Impeachment hearings will likely preempt our show tomorrow. How dare they do that to us? Stick with us later in the week. We'll hear about KC's new multi-million-dollar pet shelter. It opens to the public very soon. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.